Hey, what you're about to listen to is the podcast version of what was a live radio segment on KPFA. Consequently, when you hear us give out a call-in number, you don't want to call it. If you're listening to this as a podcast, it is already too late, and nobody on the other end of that phone number is going to have any useful answers for you. You can, however, send in a question for our next episode by shooting an email to upfront@kpfa.org. You can also tune in for the next edition live and ask your question over the phone then. We normally air Monday mornings on KPFA just after 7:30 news headlines. All right, let's go to this week's Corona Calls.
We are talking about the latest news in COVID science and public health, and we are joined, as we usually are on Monday mornings at 7:34, by Dr. John Swartzberg, Clinical Professor Emeritus of Infectious Diseases at UC Berkeley's School of Public Health. Good morning, Dr. Swartzberg.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us this week. In particular, last week the Bay Area began boasting some of the highest amounts of COVID-19 in wastewater in the state. A surge is upon us. Dr. Swartzberg, what do we know about where COVID is prevalent right now within the Bay Area and what the wastewater data tells us, or what it might not tell us?
Sure. The wastewater levels in the Bay Area sites that we're testing are higher than they've been, significantly higher than they've been in, that they were in May. So there's been a real significant change in the wastewater. And commensurate with that, we've been seeing in the last few weeks a rise in what's called the percent positivity, the percent of people who get tested because they have symptoms that are positive for COVID. And that's been rising significantly too. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of other data to tell us what's happening with COVID in the community. But I think between those two things and anecdotally, what most people that I speak with, myself included, have observed, and that is there's a lot more COVID in June than there was in May. Now, to put that in perspective, we started in May from a very low level. And so while we have a rise in cases, we still have a relatively low level of COVID in the community. What is good to see is that we're not seeing any more deaths, but deaths tend to lag behind by several weeks from what's happening in the community. Hospitals have patients with COVID, but most of them are not terribly ill. Unfortunately, since May 1st, we don't keep very careful track of hospitalizations for COVID, so we don't really know as well. All in all, I know that a lot of people are using the word surge, but you know, we use the word surge for what we saw and have seen practically every winter, many summers, the Delta surge, for example. And if we use the same word surge now, it may be conveying the wrong message. And that is, while we're seeing a rise in cases, we still have a very low number compared to those really big surges that we've been through. What we don't know, of course, nobody knows, is what this means for July and August. Will these numbers continue to rise to become much more significant, or will they level off and come down again? Anybody's guess.
I guess, just asking about this particular point of calling it a surge, what is the danger in calling a COVID uptick a surge if it would encourage people to take more precautions to not spread it right now? Would that damage, public health leaders and spokespeople's trustworthiness in the medium term if surges are too frequent? Like, what do you know about the messaging of how to tell people there's an increased risk of COVID maybe multiple times a year?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it's fair to say that those of us in public health and medicine have struggled with the question of how to communicate what this virus is doing, particularly when we can only observe what's happening at this time and not what's going to be happening in the future. I don't think it's a danger, but I think the concern is exactly as you laid out. And that is that if we say there's a surge going on now and people say, well, I don't see people in the hospitals and I don't see anything like May and June of 2020, I'm not going to believe anything I hear. So there, it would be good to have a way to explain simply to the public exactly what the data is showing us. And we lack a lot of the terminology we need. I remember back in 2021, I was starting to use the word swell as opposed to surge when there was an increase in cases, but nothing like those big surges. I don't think that really caught on very well, and I'm not sure it was the best word anyway. So it raises the big question of how best for public health to communicate to the public. And this is just one example of where we really do struggle.
All right. Not so swell. Well, we're taking your questions. If you are listening, you have questions about the latest COVID science, you can give us a call at 1-800-958-9008. We also take questions by email at coronacalls@kpfa.org. Let us know if you have questions about COVID science for Dr. Swartzberg. So speaking of the kind of skepticism around COVID news, New York Governor Kathy Hochul actually indicated over the last several weeks she may want to ban face masks on the New York City subway based on fears stoked about crime and threats on the subway. Essentially, the government wants to be able to see people's faces. This seemed notable, especially because it's from a Democratic Party governor. And people under such a scheme could obtain exceptions for health or religious reasons. But what is your reaction as a public health expert to a governor suggesting banning masking on a crowded tube of commuters like the New York City subway station?
Yeah, when I started reading about that, it made me very sad. That was my reaction. It made me sad that the world is in such a state that we have to tell people that they need to ban, they can't wear masks in the subway, a risky place to be if there's a lot of COVID going around. So I felt very sad that we were even having to have that discussion. Certainly through the public health lens, through a physician's lens, wearing a mask protects people, not only from getting COVID, but it protects those who have COVID, they may not even know it, that is, they're asymptomatically infected, from spreading it to other people. So it's a wonderful public health tool. And to tell people on the subways where people are crowded together that they can't wear a mask is extremely problematic and really flies in the face of what's safe for people to do. So, yeah, it would be, I understand the you can get an exemption for it, but how many people are really going to go and get an exemption from wearing a mask in the subway? I appreciate the problem from a legal standpoint or from a police enforcement standpoint. But if I was in New York City, I would be wearing a mask on the subway.
So back to the Bay Area uptick in COVID cases. A lot of families are traveling right now for vacations, for graduations. There are major events that are becoming super spreaders. I'm guessing that causes some of the spread right now, but what is your take on some of the factors that are causing the seasonal uptick in cases, especially in the Bay Area that we're seeing right now?
Sure. I think there are three things, and I think they're fairly obvious. One is exactly what you mentioned. That is, we have a population now where none of us are taking the same care in terms of preventing, doing the things that help us prevent getting COVID that we were doing in the winter. It's unusual to see people masking in certain situations where they're relatively high risk, indoors with crowds of people. So that's one big one. You add to that the fact that now people are traveling to events, as you mentioned, graduations, et cetera. And it's not just graduations from college that we read about all the time, but it's, of course, graduating from high school and middle school and so on. And so this puts people at risk because they're doing things they don't typically do with large groups of other people, particularly when it's indoors. Then you add to that the immunity that we have to getting infected, not getting really sick, but the immunity the population has to getting infected wanes. So the booster campaign or the vaccine campaign last fall, not enough people got it, but people got it. And the immunity they got from that protected them against infection for the 1, 2, or 3 months or so. But then that wanes pretty significantly. It continues to protect them against really serious illness that results in hospitalization or death. But we've got a lot of people right now who are very susceptible to getting infected again, even if they got boosted last fall. And if they got COVID sometime in the winter with the winter surge, then their immunity is now waning here in June. So we've got a population where their immunity to getting infected is waning. So you add all those two things together, and they really will result in increased number of cases. And then finally, we've got a subvariant of Omicron. We've got a subvariant of what's called JN.1, which caused the winter surge in cases. We've got subvariants circulating right now. They're called the flirt variants that I think many of your listeners have read about. These flirt variants are very, very contagious. Fortunately, they don't make us any sicker than the previous variants of Omicron, but they do transmit with much greater alacrity. So you have a more transmissible virus, you have a population that has less immunity, and you have people taking fewer precautions while they are doing a lot of things they may not have been doing a couple of months ago. And you mix all those together and you get high wastewater levels, and then you start to see high numbers of cases. That's exactly what we're seeing.
All right. We are taking your questions on COVID science with Dr. John Swartzberg. You can give us a call, 1-800-958-9008. We've got a listener question from Cam in Cupertino. Cam, you are on the air.
Good morning. So this so-called vaccine was supposed to protect us, right? And take care of this virus. So majority of the people have been vaccinated. How come this many years later we're still talking about a danger? What's going on, Dr. Schwarzberg?
Well, thanks, Cam, for that question. You know, let's use measles as another example first. The measles vaccine, when you get it, protects one for most people for the rest of their lives. It's an incredible vaccine. There are properties to the vaccine that allow it to do that. But very importantly, the measles virus doesn't change. It doesn't mutate. It doesn't spin off new variants. So we have a great vaccine against measles. You get it as a child, and you're really protected pretty much for the rest of your life for the vast majority of people. What's going on with COVID is the virus itself is a virus that enters our nose or throats or sometimes the lining of our eyes, and that's how it gets into our body. We call that mucosal immunity. And the vaccines that we have work only so-so against mucosal immunity. That is, you have to have a lot of antibody in your system and a lot of antibody on those surfaces to protect you from getting infected. And our vaccines only do that for a short period of time. So we lose that protection against getting infected after several months. Now, if the only thing they did was to protect us for 3 months against getting infected, it would have very little role in public health, in the public's health. But fortunately, as I was mentioning before, the vaccines give us much longer protection against really serious disease. If the virus gets into our system, it really protects us very well from that. And so that's why we see a real blunting in hospitalizations and deaths and even emergency room visits. And we attribute that to a great deal to the vaccine. So what we've got is a vaccine that gives us short term immunity, not the long term that we'd love to see. It's similar to influenza. That's why we need an influenza shot every year. The virus changes, just like SARS-CoV-2 changes. So we have to get new vaccines every year for that to keep up to date. And the immunity we get from these vaccines only lasts several months. They don't last years and years and years. What we're after and what researchers are looking at, assiduously looking at, is to develop vaccines that can accomplish two things. Well, really, three things. One is to give mucosal immunity. A second is to be able to cover any way that vaccine would, the virus would change. So if the virus mutates, the vaccine would still work. The third thing that we're looking for is a vaccine that has long duration. That is, it gives long-term protection. And there's a tremendous amount of work on all three of these things. And I think that we're going to start seeing things come out within the next couple of years, maybe even sooner, that are either steps ahead of where we are now or maybe a big leap ahead of where we are now. So we need vaccines that can cover any way that virus changes. We need vaccines that protect us, protect our mucosa, so we protect against infection. And we need vaccines that give long-term protection. And once we get those, then I don't think there's going to be any question on the value of these vaccines.
All right. We've got a few questions, write-in questions from listeners, and also a few people on the phone. So I'll try to ask these quickly. We had a write-in question from Mike in Berkeley who asked, how strictly should one adhere to the expiration date on an antigen test kit? If you use it a couple days or weeks past the expiration date, are the results still valid?
Well, we don't know. Now, it's important with the expiration date that you go onto the FDA site and make sure that the expiration date has not been extended. My wife did that from tests we had last fall, and they were good through when they were extended through May of this year. So be sure to check and make sure that the expiration date hasn't been extended. But the company can't verify that the tests will still be good after the expiration date. Now, certainly if you test and it's positive, I think you can assume that correctly that that means you have COVID. The problem is if it's negative, you don't know whether it's negative because of the expiration date or negative because you don't have COVID.
All right. We had a listener also ask, have we become lax in mask wearing? Should we resume wearing N95 masks, especially in places like a crowded indoor movie theater? And what should somebody do if they see masks are recommended and no one around them is wearing masks?
It's uncomfortable. We are communal animals, and we like to do what everybody else is doing. But my answer to this question is that if you're at high risk of a bad outcome, or if you don't want to get COVID because you have a trip planned, or you don't want to get COVID because it's going to interfere with your work, or you don't want to get COVID because you don't want to get long COVID and you don't know whether you could get that, would get that or not. So if those are the kind of questions going through your head, I think it's important to psychologically say, well, everybody has to do what they need to do, but I want to do this because I want to protect myself. I'm over 65, so I'm at high risk for a bad outcome from this virus. So if I was in a crowded movie theater, which frankly, I don't think I'd do, but if I was in a crowded movie theater, I would definitely have a mask on, and even if no one else in the theater had it on. So I think, you know, we don't like to stand out, but on the other hand, we want to protect ourselves.
All right, we're going to go back to live listener calls. On the line, we've got Omawale in Berkeley. Omawale, what is your question for Dr. Swartzberg? Good morning.
Good morning. And happy Father's Day to Dr. Swartzberg. I wanted to ask, what is the number of variants that we're looking at this time? You mentioned variants becoming even the more transmissible as we move forward over the year. And then the other part of the question was, can we ask stores and banks and post offices to reinforce the distancing requirement, because it's been very difficult, not only with people not masking, but also with people crawling up right on top of you, you know, within 2 inches, and they're standing there breathing, talking, coughing, and so forth and so on. My defense of that has been just giving out masks, you know, as I've encountered people. But what would your recommendations be on that? Thank you.
Sure. And thanks for the Father's Day wishes, Omawale. In terms of the number of subvariants of Omicron, Omicron's the only game in town right now. It's the Omicron family, and there are lots and lots and lots of subvariants identified. But the vast majority of these can't compete with some of the subvariants that are circulating. So we have a relatively small number, 10, 15, that are circulating and surviving. And it's like a horse race. And there are several horses right now leading the pack. They're called the flirt variants that I was mentioning before, particularly KP.1 and 0.2, and they're way ahead in the pack. But there's this new one coming up that's from a different lineage that's about 12% of the cases now. So we're looking at lots of different subvariants, but only one or two tends to win the horse race at any particular time. In terms of the question about distancing, I had two immediate comments on that. One is, as a society, and public health has essentially switched its decision-making from public health dicta or governmental dicta to individual decision-making. By that, I mean the government, public health, is no longer telling businesses what they have to do in terms of protecting their customers and their workers. The individuals have to decide what they want to do. So it's really flipped the responsibility that we had in the first part of the pandemic to the government telling people what was safest for them and telling how things had to operate, to now saying each individual has to make their own decision. The other reaction I had to your question was about distancing itself. There's been a lot of talk by some, I think, fairly ill-informed people in the government about decisions made about the six-foot rule. That is, if you want to be outside of at least 6 feet away from somebody to get infected, that does give you protection. The further you are away from somebody who's infected, the less likely you're going to inhale their virus that they've expelled from their nose or throat. So the six-foot rule is a reasonable rule. Where the problem is that this virus can spread in large and medium-sized droplets that fall to the ground within 6 feet, and you're protected from that if you're 8 feet away. But this virus can also spread in very small droplets that can remain in the air for long periods of time. Sometimes there's no air circulation, an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours. And it can travel 30 meters. So you could be way away from somebody and still get infected. So the further you are away from someone, the safer you are. But you're still, even if you're a long way away, but you're indoors with poor air circulation, you still could be inhaling somebody's virus from a long distance from you.
All right. We've got to leave it there. Thank you for our listeners for calling in. Thank you to Dr. Swartzberg for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, that does it for this week's edition of Corona Calls. If you want to send in a question for the next one, you can shoot an email anytime to upfront@kpfa.org, or you can tune in live. We normally broadcast Mondays just after 7:30 news headlines on KPFA. We put a little bit of extra work into repackaging this live segment as a podcast because it feels like the information is useful to a lot of people, and we ought to make it accessible through as many channels as possible. You can help us get the word out by rating and reviewing it in whatever app you're using to listen. And if you want to pitch in some cash, we wouldn't say no. We always take donations at kpfa.org. I appreciate it if you mentioned Corona Calls when you make your pledge. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiegert. I hope you have a great week. Stay well. We'll talk to you next time.